You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Bharati Mukherjee, the author of The Holder of the World, most recently published by Knopf. She's the author as well of Yasmin and the book of short stories, Middlemen, which won the National Book Award. But I have to tell my listeners that the entire day before this interview I've spent with Holder of the World, I'm absolutely transfixed by it. It's brand new for you, isn't it? This is the first historical book you've done, and it's kind of an adventure and kind of a saga and kind of a gender politics book and kind of a literary self-contained artifact. And, you know, all of these things are brand new.
I suppose they are, and that all my novels are covert or accidental autobiographies. And so the novels become expressions of what obsesses me at any given, at the time of writing. And I'm one of those very socially aware, politically committed new Americans. So that gender, politics, race, diaspora especially, all feed themselves, I hope, in very dramatic ways and, you know, interesting in terms of narrative ways into novels.
But before this, I remember last time we spoke, for instance, we spoke about paragraphs and the, you know, kind of jumpy and edgy style of those earlier books, which are very contemporary and very jostled with the presence of the whole melting pot and its refusal to be contained in normal sentences. This book has very weird sentences in it too, but it's contained within the form, I don't know exactly what to say, of, well, like a Kipling novel.
I don't think so. what I wanted was to find a new form for the American novel that expresses adequately the informational overload that people like me, CNN addicts, who never turn their television on, even when we're writing fiction, suffer from or are blessed with. And I wanted also a novel form that reflects the extraordinary speed of the lives that we lead. I feel I'm a 400-year-old woman who's lived through many incarnations and many cultures in one decade. And so I need always to break the conventional Eurocentric format of the novel and find sentence structures as well as organizational structures that are both postmodern and at the same time playing on helping me understand the colonial, pre-colonial, post-colonial, postmodern layers of lives like mine.
Well, but in an odd way, like Nabokov's Ada, this America is one viewed by an Indian author that contains Boston Brahmins and American Indians, and it's as if the past is being sifted for a primal connection with the world that your ancestors knew.
Primal connection, that's exactly the phrase. Thank you for finding the phrase for me. That's exactly behind the writing of this novel. I did 11 years of research because I was interested in trying to understand the making of the American consciousness. And what I discovered during the research was how the whole world came to colonial Salem ports, and that the official histories, and especially white male American social critics such as the late Alan Blooms, seem to have excised the multiculturalism, the raucousness of colonial America. And I also discovered, as I did, the meticulous and totally mesmerizing reading of all the logbooks of European East India Trading Company documents, as well as the 17th century history of India, Mughal Imperial India, how multicultural the Coromandel coast of India was. Not only were there Danes, British, Dutch, French, and Portuguese, but the Mughal army was filled with Ethiopian generals and Abyssinian soldiers and European gunners, artillerymen. So that multiculturalism fascinated me. And the more I researched, I discovered that the logbooks of these trading companies were, again, the official histories of the male explorers and adventurers, but that there were, if you like, lipstick traces in their references to the secret history that should have been written by European women who went out there. So that's what then made the novel take off.
One of these lipstick traces, to use Gril Marcus's phrase, is the... Well, I remember when I would ask my mother how she knew something I didn't think she could know, she'd tell me that a little birdie told her. This is a novel which is, to speak a bit cryptically, about the little birdie that told Nathaniel Hawthorne's great-grandfather the seeds that led to the Scarlet Letter. And so it's an embedding into American colonial consciousness of a whole tradition of Muslim and Hindu lore that by the time we reach, in the Scarlet Letter, Pearl, the heiress of all the generations and the pearl of great price, she is the consummate seed of all these narrative and historical and political traditions.
Absolutely. That's what was my most exciting discovery, that the actual history of the times that Hawthorne wrote about in the Scarlet Letter was so marvelously raucous and multicultural. And out of the history, the Scarlet Letter and Hawthorne, text and author I admire enormously, but that a Puritan writer took from that ribald and raucous history what he needed for his Puritan novel. But the Scarlet Letter, A, was only the first in the alphabet about American history that the rest of us will continue to write.
I'm speaking to Bharati Mukherjee, the author most recently of The Holder of the World. Still, you know, when I read the earlier books, I've read, I think, three of your novels. There's one book of short stories, Darkness, that I haven't read. They are full of a certain kind of threat that after the people you write about are finished, the inherited American language will not be the same as it was. And that everything, bombs going off, you know, the whole world had better start to respond because it isn't going to have a choice anymore. This novel, as disruptive as it is a much more traditional novel.
Do you think so?
Well,
I wanted virtual reality as my access into the historical genres. I'd be too bored to write the conventional historical novel. And so I wanted to experience history, and I wanted my narrator and my readers also to experience history rather than be served up dead, inert data on a platter. And I never know when I start out who is going to become the main character and take over my entire skull and what is going to happen in the novel.
Well, I guess what I mean is, in terms of traditional, I guess I mean structured. In the earlier books, anything might have happened. In this book, you know, it is a whole, and you read the novel waiting to learn about things that you're told or that are hinted to you on the very first page. So it's hierarchical.
All right, I'm playing with the conventions of the historical novel. And there is, of course, a through line, the pursuit.
The missing diamond.
Yes, oh, for the most perfect diamond in the world. But that, like the Maltese falcon, is either a MacGuffin, or like the quest for the golden fleece, is really the object is not as important as the process of self-discovery, the journey itself.
Which seems to be one of the classic morals of storytelling itself. John Barth has it that the key to the treasure is the treasure, but it's more that the search is the discovery. The search is more interesting than any discovery. And this novel ultimately involves all sorts of, well, making newfangled, old-fangled devices. Because of virtual reality and its computer generation, time travel, or as this book calls it, time retrieval, becomes a possibility for the characters, and our present tense characters enter at the climactic point, history 300 years before, to find the missing diamond.
That time retrieval was my breakthrough, and I've become more and more interested because I live in such a state of informational overload myself. How to design information? How to Somalia, Haiti, come into my study within a single 5-minute unit, if you like. And so how to possess all this information and make sense of it. So information design is very much behind the structuring of or finding a new format for the American novel.
And yet the books that seem also behind this book, the books that are being jimmied open or fooled with, seem classically to be called boys' books. She, for instance, or the H.G. Wells stuff, Time Machine. And it's sort of amusing to find a book that's so feminist taking as its sort of springboard these boys' novels of adventure.
I grew up in Calcutta immediately after independence, of course, immersed in books like Rita Haggard's She and H.G. Wells and Boys' Adventures. But now I've discovered how women also not only reflected the times but transcended the times. And it's simply that no one told the stories of those women. What got my character, Hannah East, in the 17th century woman started is having seen at a previewing for an auction at Sotheby's of Indian miniature paintings a painting entitled An European Woman in Emperor Aurangzeb's Court. And there was this woman with golden ringlets standing in ornate Mughal dress on a terrace in very conventional painterly posture. And I thought, my God, who was she? How had she transformed herself so that she'd strayed out of the white town of her white compatriots, other wives of traders, and accommodated or adapted or survived somehow in a totally alien? She'd kept herself open to that alien culture, which in a way is my story. So that's what got me started. And I wanted to find an appropriate way in fiction to talk about the continual transformations that are going on in America. To be an American is to be in constant flux. So 1990s with people like me, as well as for the 17th century, Hester Prynne's and Pearl Prynne's. I always felt The Scarlet Letter was an immigrant novel, of course.
Well, you know, it is interesting because there is that sense in the final scenes of The Scarlet Letter when Hester is playing in the forest with Pearl and that dappling of light and shade. Maybe it's just my imagination of the book having just finished yours, but it does seem like a picture of goddesses, you know, like a birth of the future.
I hope so. And I never know when I'm writing it what I've done. But when I finished, I knew that Hannah Easton, together with whatever it is that she has taught Bea Masters, the modern narrator, they're going to give us myths to survive the crisis of the national identity crisis in the U.S. that we're about to enter.
I'm speaking to Bharati Mukherjee, the author of The Holder of the World, her most recent novel published recently by Knopf. Now, I wanted to go to another aspect of the novel, the subject of time and history. It seemed to me that you were mentioning those miniature paintings and the extraordinary detail with which you render them, almost comic, because these paintings are very small.
Very
and,
tiny.
And veins are noticed on people's hands. And, you know, it's microscopic. And that amount of information in a small place becomes a version, art's version, of the information on a computer chip to make a virtual reality. And a lot of the research behind the novel seems to be a parody of the new historicism that goes to records of ships and small transactions, the idea that history is the history of daily life, so that the book seems finally to be about the difference between daily life, virtual reality. History is told by men and Westerners. History is told by a more multicultural interest or grouping. And finally, art, which wants to select for itself only what it needs.
Oh, Michael, you're my ideal reader. I could talk to you for days. Yes, on the one hand, I want to tell a good story with strong plot, and I can't help but have very strong women characters simply because I think my mother, in her very quiet way, brought up in a very Orthodox family in Calcutta, where being a woman meant you couldn't be educated, you had to be married off very early, was a very quiet feminist. And so I can't help having strong women characters. But beyond that, yes, my books become, whether I want them to or not, meditations on storytelling itself, finding new narrative strategies, and meditations on the mega social issues of multiculturalism, race antagonisms, the politics of ethnicity and the commodification of that kind of, the dangerous commodification of ethnicity. So, yeah, it's very much about different ways in which we discover information and the new historicists on the one hand. And I want to think that in this novel, Van Eyer, who's the new pioneer, if you like, the India-born American citizen who's chosen to be American, as I have, is the enabler for the Bea Masters of this world, the traditional heirs, Puritan heirs to the Puritan American dream, to complete that American dream, that it's all coming together and that the artist will make something of the inputted data by the technicians. So knowledge, if Chillingworth, the man of knowledge in Hawthorne, was a nasty figure, then I'm neutralizing the nastiness of knowledge, the demonizing of search for knowledge.
You know, there's a great title. It's probably not his, but they gave one of the collections of Isaac Bobble's stories the title, You Must Know Everything. And to some extent, when I was reading The Holder of the World, I became aware of how much of Indian literature and theological literature I not only don't know, but I'm unaware of. Who is to be the teacher, and how does that instruction take place? Is it in novels like yours, or...
I don't want to be ever didactic, but before I answer the question, I have to tell you that you've really found the key to my fiction, because Isaac Babel is the most important author for me.
Oh,
yes, wow. That I learned the art of compression and bizarre dramatic irony from the short stories, especially the Odessa stories of Babel, and that sense of a community that is raucous, full of life, and at the same time minority and sometimes victimized by the dominant culture in Babel's Odessa stories. I want to think that what fiction writers do, or what I want to do in fiction, as opposed to essays, polemical, political essays, is to provide a kind of full moral, emotional resonance to the times, to see sympathetically into the hearts of the bad guys as well as the so-called good guys, that there are no clear-cut victimizers and victims, and that we are all capable of virtues and vices. Whereas a polemicist or the writer who writes propaganda, thesis-ridden fiction, can only be a trivial writer of fiction because they make their characters represent group rage and group thinking.
No, but what I mean is this. Take someone like me. I'm willing, I hope, to overcome a Eurocentric Western education that taught me certain things, so that when I was reading The Holder of the World, I was aware, I was embarrassed to know that there were things that I've never been taught, you know, worlds that I don't know. And I wondered, where and how does that re-education, or can that re-education begin?
Well, I hope that what fiction will do is open up those worlds, will prick your curiosity so that you will then find out for yourself, and that it will, the job of fiction, I think, is to enlarge the reader's sympathy, make the reader a more generous, spirited person.
Well, this novel, for instance, lets this reader know what it feels like when an elephant is walking across the carnage of a finished battle. It's full of the sound of the crushing of skulls and the sway of the howdah on the elephant's back. And yet it was almost as if when I was reading the story of the goddess Sita, which made me think in turn of how interesting the idea advanced in the narrative is, that every time a woman marries, she's entering another incarnation, that this is a part of the projection of the goddess or woman in her phases. I wanted, as soon as I finished the book, not to read The Scarlet Letter, which this book presumptuously becomes the grandma of, but to know more of the literature that generated this world. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right. Oh, if I've succeeded in doing that for you as a reader, I'm totally thrilled, because I wanted to open up the times.
But tell me, because, you know, I don't want to, as a result of reading this, go and read Kim, but what should I be reading?
You should be reading the histories of the times. And just as the equivalence of Rider Haggard, in some sense, those that are not pretentiously serious literature, but who are able to squeeze the whole universe carelessly, naturally, into a tiny frame. And I was playing with the Sita narratives, or any of those, with the Mary Rowlandson-like captivity narratives of the Puritan American times. And I realized how many affinities there are in the myths, and that it's simply a way, what I finding in myself more and more are fresh ways of looking at the old material, old data, and that then feeds into new narratives.
I'm curious, you know, by the way, I'm talking to Bharati Mukherjee, the author of The Holder of the World, published by Knopf. Now that you've done a book that has the past and time travel and literature and goddesses and stolen diamonds, the gamut of story. Do you feel,
I'm at work on a new novel.
Do you feel compelled, though, to bring it? What happened to the American novel, for instance, in the 60s, when it found a certain level of complexity, was that it kept raising that level to more and more complicated issues of narration. Do you feel the need to find, having done time travel, flying carpets and genies, is it?
No. Should I?
I don't know.
I'm afraid not. What I do is ideas for novels gel in my head for decades sometimes. And the novel that I'm working on now came out of a trial that I'd witnessed of a serial killer in 1977. But what it has become now is a totally different novel. And so I realized that it's the character or an idea that evolves in very surprising ways to me over years. And what I realize that I'm writing about in this novel in progress is diasporic rage. I am part of a natural diaspora. You know, history has deposited me in the U.S. because I was born into a particular post-colonial time in India. And what about the people in the United States who are not clear-cut India-born or Latino or African-American? What happens to the people who are not privileged by that kind of confident ethnic heritage? And how do they deal with diaspora? So the rage of the diasporic person in the U.S. is what this novel is. And, of course, lots of action and strong mother-daughter line.
What's the title?
Justin, I won't tell you simply because it may change.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you for being with us, Bharati.
Thank you, Michael.
I've been speaking to Bharati Mukherjee, the author of The Holder of the World, published by Knopf. My name is Michael Silverblatt. This has been Bookworm. My engineer has been Scott Fritz, and my associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Join us again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.